How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. I'm also a certified genetic counselor practicing in the prenatal space. On this show, we explore genetics impact on our health through conversations with leaders in the field. This episode is a special installment. We are sharing a recording of the Phenotype Speaker Series. This is a monthly webinar that's hosted by myself and sponsored by Phenotypes. During these live events, I interview leaders in the field of genetics and moderate questions live from the audience. The next live webinar I'll be hosting is on November 23rd at noon Eastern. I'm excited to explore the future of cancer genetics in this installment. So you can check out all upcoming installments by heading over to phenotypes.com, where you can also stream all the webinars from the last year and a half. So I hope to see you at the live event. Again, that's November 23rd. We're going to be talking about the adoption and impact of digital tools in genetic counseling. So we're going to start with a 45-minute panel discussion with our lovely panelists here. And then we're going to be answering your questions at the end of the webinar. So a little bit about our sponsor of the series, Phenotypes. They are the world's first genomic health record system, and they've designed software and services that bring workflow to genetic professionals like us. So they've developed tools like pedigree builders, standardized symptom capture, and diagnostic insights. As many of us know, electronic health records are not designed specifically for genetics. So Phenotypes saw the need for this and fills in those gaps by really designing a complete suite for genomic medicine. So in light of the pandemic, Phenotypes is sponsoring this speaker series so that we can all learn from home, and we're all learning from around the globe during the series. So it's very exciting to be connecting with all of you. As I mentioned, I'm your host, Kira Dineen, the host for this webinar. I'm also the host of the podcast DNA Today. We are very excited that we recently won the People's Choice Award for the best 2020 Science and Medicine podcast. So we've been making podcasts for the last 8 years. We've got over 130 episodes of conversations like the ones we have today, all about genetics. And Scott Weissman was on an episode about 4 years ago. So there's certainly a lot of familiar faces that have been on the show. And I'm also a prenatal genetic counselor during the day. So as I mentioned, today's webinar topic is going to be talking about digital tools for genetic counselors. As genetic counselors, the four of us are very busy, and we're relying more and more on digital tools to be efficient, prevent burnout. And so we're going to be talking about all of the advantages to using digital tools, but also talking about the barriers that we face in adopting these tools, either as genetic departments or genetic counselors ourselves. So exciting topics that we're diving into with these three experts today. I'd love to hear from each of you just to introduce yourselves to the audience. Andrew, if you'd like to start, that would be great.
Sure. So my name's Andy McCarty. I'm a laboratory genetic counselor at PerkinElmer Genomics and manager of genomic client services. In my limited free time, I'm also founder and operator of Clover Genetics, which is a telehealth private practice that focuses on improving access to genetic information and services in underserved areas. I have varied interests, but certainly interest in neurogenetics, immune genetics, anything to do with telehealth, and really using technology to improve access to genetic information and genetic services.
Fantastic. Scott, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Scott Weissman. I too am a genetic counselor by training. I've been mostly working in the adult space for my 20 years with really a focus on cancer genetics. I'm currently the lead of cancer services at Genome Medical. And like Andy, in my limited free time, I also have a private practice in the Chicago area called Chicago Genetic Consultants, where I'm seeing individuals who have done their own genetic testing, looking for help with interpretation for direct-to-consumer testing or consumer-directed testing, and have been doing that for about 4 years. So thank you for the invite today.
Yeah, fantastic to have us. So Amy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Amy Taylor. I'm lead consultant genetic counsellor at Cambridge University Hospitals in the UK. We are the genetic service that cover the east of England, and I lead a team of 14 genetic counsellors and trainees. So I've been a genetic counsellor for 11 years. I've been registered with the UK Genetic Counsellor Registration Board since 2011. And prior to training as a genetic counsellor, I did a PhD, which was in the genetics of deafness. So that was one of my interests, but my sort of clinical interests now are more cancer genetics, cardiac genetics, and I'm also the genetic counsellor for our specialist NF2 clinic.
So we have lots of expertise covered throughout lots of areas of genetic counseling. And what really brings you all together is your interest in digital tools. So I would love to hear how each of you utilize digital tools in your practice as kind of an overview so that people are more familiar with how you're using digital tools. Scott, would you like to start out on this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, with Genome Medical, we are a telegenomics practice that is nationwide. And so we have a large volume of patients coming in. In order to really work with all those patients, we have to be efficient at the services that we provide. So we really kind of thought about using digital tools in two ways. So one is by doing pedigrees digitally. So having patients maybe fill out a family history questionnaire that auto-generates a pedigree. A lot of the tools that are on the market offer that kind of service, if you will. And then some of these tools also allow you to run risk models for your cancer patients. So instead of having to kind of pull out of a model, go into a new one, re-enter all the information, you can really do it all in one setting, which is definitely time efficient. And then the other digital tool that we are in the process of developing is really more of a choose your own adventure type of genetic counseling, where we're providing video education to patients that would take them through the education process about, you know, genetics, cancer, genetic testing, with a series of videos that they can kind of pick and choose which ones that they want to watch. And then as they're going through those videos, answering questions about their personal and family history, that's really allowing that to generate a pedigree, where when then the patient actually gets to the genetic counselor, the patient's been educated, we have a pedigree drawn, and then we're really maybe spending less time with the patients, but that time that we're spending is really more focused on really facilitating decision-making about genetic testing and really allowing us to do psychosocial assessments of the patient's needs. So it's really taking maybe the 45 to 60 minute process and perhaps getting it down to maybe, 20 minutes face-to-face with the patient to allow more scalability and see more patients.
So it allows the patients to start understanding and conceptualizing these topics so that when they are face-to-face or telehealth meeting with a genetic counselor, that they've already processed some of this information. You're not spending as much time on that more basic information, and you're spending the conversation focused on their particular questions and speeding that along a little bit.
Exactly. And there's a lot of centers around the country that have really looked at this type of model, providing video education upfront. And it really is effective. Patients retain the knowledge the same way that they do with the genetic counselor. But again, it really, like you said, it allows them to come to the session with very targeted and specific questions and concerns that you can really then spend the time practicing at top of scope as a genetic counselor.
Yeah, fantastic to hear of. Like, that's the insight and how it's been working for Genome Medical. And so, Amy, what has your experience been so far of using digital tools and how that's helped kind of your day-to-day practice?
So our hospital went fully digital in 2014, October 2014, actually. So we've just passed our 6-year anniversary. The transition was fairly painful, but actually it's completely paid off, particularly now, because you can just access everything from everywhere. Working from home, we can see all of our patients' records. So that's when we adopted Phenotips, and we did it because the hospital was adopting Epic as our electronic medical record. But an Epic are developing some genetic specific tools, but at the time in 2014, that was not really an option. So we needed a way to store not just our patients' medical information, but family medical information. And we previously had family specific files where we'd be storing information about multiple family members, including people who we hadn't seen, but who we'd gathered, past reports and so on, genetic test reports from other centres. It's not appropriate for us to put those on the patient's medical record partly because it causes confusion. Somebody who doesn't look carefully might think that a genetic test report on a relative is actually for the patient, partly because actually that's the patient's confidential medical record, and they can request access to it at any time. So really everything on that record needs to be specific to the patient. So instead, we've adopted phenotypes as our family information source. So it's where we store all the family history forms that currently our patients send back, pathology reports, genetic test reports on other relatives, and those are accessible anywhere. So I can be logged in and accessing those things at the same time as somebody else. We don't have to pass bits of paper around. And the other sort of more basic thing that we're doing, particularly at the moment, is video calling. So we're doing a lot more telemedicine. We started off doing telephone clinics. We're now doing some video clinics. And I find that sharing the screen with a patient is a real boon in that, because so I can show them the pedigree as I'm drawing it. It makes it more of a shared space with the patient. But other things as well, visual aids, which I was not able to use over the phone, I'm able to use when I do video calls.
Yeah, so there's certainly so many aspects I feel like that you hit on. And one of them, most notably, being that you can access this information from home. So during this pandemic, so many people are working now from home and doing the telehealth consulting. And just the fact that you're able to do that, but also that patients can access their own information, which is not going to be the case when you have, things like Cerner, Epic, where you have such a huge, large database that it's not as tailorable to certain practices. So interesting to see how that's kind of happened for you, especially the last 6 years of having so many years now with this to learn and adapt from it and see what's working best for your practice. So Andrew, would you like to chime in on how you've been using digital tools?
Of course. So much like Scott and Amy, we do utilize phenotypes for pedigree trawling, which has worked out well for us. In addition, administratively, we've really looked at trying to use some tools to make the process more efficient as far as getting patients in and triaged appropriately. So on the scheduling side, we've been working with some automated forms of scheduling that is sort of like a choose your own adventure of, okay, this is the question I have for the genetic counselor. Perhaps it's a family history of cancer versus some neurogenetic question, and scheduling appropriately in that area. So that's one area we've been using. And then as far as intake and pre-screens, we've looked to develop a number of different forms that we're able to use, again, to make sure that the time with the genetic counselor is used most efficiently so that we can scale that and have more patients seen in a shorter amount of time, given the obvious shortage of genetic professionals out there. So those are two additional ways we've utilized beyond family history drawing.
So we see just like how many areas of, it's not just pedigree builders. I think that's one that genetic counselors think of first when we think of digital tools, but really looking at it from electronic health record standpoint of it being bigger than that. We've touched a little bit, but I'd like to dive into more of the benefits that you've seen of using these digital tools. And, you know, we've talked about like for us as clinicians, but also tapping into what patients are getting out of this too. Amy, did you want to start us out on talking about these benefits of digital tools in our practices?
Sure. I mean, so access anywhere is helpful for us, but it's also brilliant for MDT working. So when we're getting together as a team, and we're doing most of our multidisciplinary meetings on Zoom these days, and it means that we can all see the same thing. So either when we're presenting a case, we can somebody can share their screen and show a pedigree. Actually, the other thing that we do is we're all on our laptops looking things up at the same time, and actually, in some ways, it's more effective than when we all used to sit in a room together, where there'd be one person operating the computer. Now you can have 10 different people looking at different things and all contributing actively to that meeting. So the kind of tools we'll be using in that, you know, we're looking at variants on websites, but we're also maybe looking at the patient's record, looking at information that we've gathered on other family members at the same time. So that's been kind of progress in a way, actually, from when we were meeting in person. And the other thing is, even away from an MDT scenario, sometimes you might ask somebody for a second opinion. In the days when we had paper notes, you'd have to take that set of paper notes to them, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to review the information. Now I can literally just send a message to somebody who can look up all the same information from wherever they happen to be. And we can either have a call about it, or they can just send me a message back. So I think it's made those sort of discussions about patients, which can be so crucial in making decisions, getting the right expert input. It's made that much more fluid, I think.
Yeah, certainly. Scott, do you have something to add into this, the benefits of using these digital tools for you and patients?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think from the patient perspective, one of the things that we always have a challenge when the patient shows up for the appointment generally is you start taking the family history and they start asking questions. You start asking questions like, well, I don't know if my mom had this or that. Can I call her? Can I text her real quickly? So I think with some of the digital tools, patients can really log in, see what they need, pause it, log out, call their family members, and you're really getting a richer data set of what is going on in your patient's family history because they've had the time to ask family members up front. So again, you're getting better information to provide risk assessment and do genetic counseling and make genetic testing recommendations in those situations. You know, for the clinicians, I really tend to agree with what Amy said. I think having the digital tools really allows multiple people to be accessing the same thing at the same time. So if you are doing some sort of tumor board, case conference, whatever it may be, everybody can access it, can share it. And then again, I think for really when you're working with multiple families to be able to connect family members in your internal tool. So if you do have a team of genetic counselors and not the same genetic counselor isn't working with each individual in the family, you have a way for your colleagues to see who else in the family's been seen, what their information is, what their test results are, so that again, those individuals really have the most up-to-date information about those families.
Yeah, it really speeds it up to be able to like link pedigrees together to say, oh, we met with their brother, so let's bring in that family history and then just update it for that patient because maybe it's been a couple years or something at that point of just you think about how much time that saves. And I think we've all been there of taking a family history and they're like, oh, can I call my mom or grandmother or whoever because they're the experts for the family history. And so kind of saving that time is certainly very advantageous and to already have that information going into that. Andrew, do you have anything to add about the advantages to digital tools?
Yes, I would certainly say, you know, organizational is one, just being able to have all the pedigrees in one place. I know that's one thing, certainly initially when I started the career of becoming a GC of organizing things, it is a challenge. So having these digital tools really keeps everything in one place, which I think is helpful. And then sort of on the lab side of things, you know, having this data in a digital format makes quantifying it in a way that a lab can utilize easier, you know, as far as, you know, portals that can submit data like facial data, as well as, you know, pedigrees, things of that nature, just makes that process a lot smoother and then can help the lab better analyze the data that they're identifying through genetic testing and, you know, lead to potentially better outcomes, diagnosis, things like that. So I think there's that benefit there as well, and certainly hope to see that improve over in the future.
Yeah. So not only are we saving time, making things more efficient, the quality of care ends up improving because we have all this information and because things are streamlined. Do you work in a lab? Want to receive rewards when you order supplies? Check out Thermo Fisher Scientific's Aspire program. It's a rewards program created with scientists like you in mind. All members receive a free full-size trial product every year. Points are earned every time you use or purchase products. Rewards include science-themed apparel like a zip-up DNA hoodie. Check it out at thermofisher.com/aspire-DNA today. For a limited time, you can receive 500 bonus points. Again, that's thermofisher.com/aspire-DNA today for 500 bonus points. See the show notes for terms and conditions and that link. Do you know the power of polygenic risk scores? Polygenic risk scores allow healthcare providers to more effectively help patients lower their risk of life-threatening diseases. Alelica has designed cutting-edge tools to reduce the impact of common diseases through genomic medicine. Polygenic risk score analysis and reporting can be conducted through Alelica's secure and trusted platform. Their end-to-end polygenic risk score pipeline can determine a patient's absolute risk of common diseases through a simple file upload of their genotype data. Alelica's polygenic risk score modules for new score discovery and validation perform the work of a team of bioinformaticians. This enables researchers to generate the best performing polygenic risk scores using multiple gold standard algorithms. Publication-ready results can be achieved without months of bioinformatics efforts. Learn more in our upcoming episode with Alelica in January, but if you can't wait, head over to alelica.com. Alelica, empowering the next generation of clinical genomics. Do you or someone you know have Prader-Willi syndrome? You should check out a new clinical study in the United States. This study will be evaluating the safety and impact of an investigational medication on excessive daytime sleepiness, cognition, and behavioral function in people with Prader-Willi syndrome. Use the link in the show notes to learn more about the clinical study and refer a patient to a study center. The link is also available at dnapodcast.com. More clinical studies for genetic conditions can be found at norare.com. One question that I was curious about is how patients respond to a digital pedigree as opposed to the old school pen and paper. Because when we're using pen and paper, usually, you know, it feels like we're very involved. We're doing this together. They can see what you're doing as you're doing it. You know, for some of the cases, like Scott, you were mentioning that sometimes patients are filling this in ahead of time. So you're more looking at the pedigree that they've kind of created themselves. But for patients that you're taking the pedigree while they're there, either in person or telehealth, what that experience looks like. And Andrew, we could start with you this round if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah. So interestingly, for my thesis in graduate school, I looked at something like this. So we looked at taking a paper pedigree with patients and then doing a digital pedigree with patients. And we found, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was quite significant. I think about 80% of individuals who had a digital pedigree taken, and this was in 2014 or so, were interested in having a copy, citing reasons such as, you know, sharing it with their physician, sharing it with their family to gather more information. Whereas with the paper pedigree, I believe it was closer to 10%. And, you know, there's a lot of factors involved there, but I think it was just, you know, interesting to see that there's certainly an increased interest there, perhaps based on, you know, how the pedigree looks in that form, or an interest at that time that was earlier when maybe some of these tools weren't as pervasive. So it's just, you know, a novelty. But in any case, I think it was something I'm interested in exploring further as I think, you know, it can help with more communication to improve patient care.
Yeah, definitely. And when it's digital, the handwriting is not an obstacle. So I'm sure that's a big part of it, of, you know, you look over and you're going through pedigree, you're trying to go through quick, they're talking about stories, you're adding this and that. And then you come back and look at it, you're like, well, it's legible, but it's not necessarily the most beautiful piece of artwork that I've made. So I don't know if you've had anything more to add to that, Amy, of experiences of having patients have digital pedigrees drawn instead of the physical ones.
I mean, I haven't drawn a paper pedigree in quite a long time. And actually, we do a lot of our family history gathering prior to clinic as well. But I have always found when I show somebody their digital pedigree, particularly if we've drawn, the way that we do it at the moment, and we hope that we'll get to a stage where patients can fill in the information digitally, but at the moment they fill in a paper family history form, which then becomes a digital pedigree. And they usually love seeing that. It's kind of exciting for them to see their family in this format. And I also find when I take the pedigree in clinic, or when I was using it face to face more so than now, either I take it in clinic or I'm adding to it. So even if they've sent in some stuff beforehand, that we'll be building it in clinic. It really feels like, I know the paper feels so more personal, but actually I think digital almost feels more like a shared space. I would put my laptop between the two of us. Sometimes I get patients to type if their relatives had difficult to spell names. And then it just does feel like a sort of a shared activity, and they're really kind of contributing to their consultation.
That can be a really great way to do it, so that it's facing both of you if you are in person. And if you're not, then you can have the ability to share your screen. And, you know, as you were saying before, Amy, like sometimes that's even better when everybody has their own computers to access that information. So kind of taking away that barrier of the physical laptop between you and saying, all right, let's work on this together. It's kind of a project for the next, you know, few minutes to say, let's figure out and build this family tree together. Scott, do you have anything to chime in about, you know, the patient experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are just two things. You know, one is just I think the idea that everything is digital, right? There's so much on your phone and apps and everything else that when you break out a piece of paper and a stencil, sometimes you get like a cockeyed look, like, wait, what are you doing? Like every other medical professional I work with is on a computer. Like, what is this? So I think there is that kind of idea that, you know, what we're doing is kind of a forward part of healthcare. Like, we are in the digital age. And maybe not so much for the patients, but maybe more for providers, is that, you know, if you have that hand-drawn pedigree, right, you have to send that to get it scanned into your EHR. And so then the patient updates you, and how do you go about updating that pedigree? Are you redrawing it? Do you send a note? Do you then have multiple copies of pedigrees in your EHR? Because good luck getting something out of the EHR once it's in it. So the idea that, you know, you don't have something digitally that you can kind of easily updates, and then again, kind of have that most up-to-date version constantly available, is just, it I think kind of goes against a lot of the stuff that we do as providers.
Yeah, that's a really good point of just like being able to update it. And yeah, you really can't get rid of something once it's in that EMR. And so kind of another aspect of this that I think Andrew may have touched on at one point is the diagnostic process. So we've been talking a lot about pedigree builders, but digital tools can also be useful in that diagnostic journey. So how do we see that they are useful? How are they being used during this diagnostic process? And we can start with you, Amy.
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer this one, because I had to think about this question, and I'm not sure. So I, for instance, I don't use the Phenotips has a lot more functionality than I personally use, particularly for diagnostic coding of dysmorphology cases. For instance, you can put in a lot of diagnostic codes and it will suggest diagnoses, but they're not the kinds of cases that I tend to see. So I don't tend to use that. The thing I was thinking, though, was about diagnostic coding and how helpful that can be. So if we code well in our digital tools, whether that's in Phenotips, where you can add a gene. So if you add a gene, you can add a variant as well. And then let's say this happens all the time, you get an update. Oh, well, now these people need to have this screening. And then you can just search your entire database and find all the people where you've recorded that they have a pathogenic variant in that gene. Similarly, within our electronic medical records, we can do that, although it's pretty unwieldy and quite difficult to write, and also fundamentally relies on people coding it well in the first place, which tends to be where these things fall down.
Yeah, so being able to actually find and just search for, you're saying, like a certain gene or maybe even a certain variant, and then having those patients pop up.
Yeah, but actually in a simpler way as well, searchable medical records are such a boon. Like, if you've got a question about a patient, the record can be so busy, and it can be so lots of people have written things in it. You can search it. Like, if you've got a question, has this person had this? And that's part of your diagnostic process. You can just search their entire chart for it, and it'll search through everybody's notes, everybody's letters. So it's definitely got more capability than, for instance, previously you'd get a big pile of hospital notes and have to work through them.
Right. It's like, good luck. That's going to be your whole afternoon there. Yeah.
Yeah, at least.
Definitely. Andrew, you've had more experience with pediatrics and having this be more of the process. What has been your experience using this in the diagnostic process?
So I think it comes down to, you know, again, having those pedigrees in front of you in an easy to access manner. Cascade testing is one thing that comes to mind. You know, you diagnose something in one individual's and you have to test the parents, other relatives. So that can be a value. I think another thing, and I believe it's still sort of in development, but tools such as facial recognition that are being integrated into exome analysis. I don't know if that's happening with pedigrees yet, but I certainly see a possibility of doing that. And so it may just, you know, add to the ability to through a bioinformatic pipeline for analysis for different findings. But yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else, but that's what I have for now.
Yeah, and something certainly that we're looking at as more additions are made to these tools. So that's almost something more, I suppose, as a preview and something that's more up and coming. Scott, anything to add on to the diagnostic process?
Yeah, I would just really kind of echo what Amy said. I don't use it in that way, but one of the reasons that we actually started using phenotypes and wanted phenotypes to be our main tool is this idea that they're really kind of built for exomes and genomes in the sense that you can add in features related to HPO ontology for your patients, and then it will pull up a differential diagnosis of possible conditions to be thinking about. And you can actually upload, I believe, VCF files into the system as well and store them there. So if we get to that point where really everybody's having an exome or a genome and we get away from panels, it just seemed like it had a lot of power to be able to store data files, phenotype information to really make it more of a diagnostic tool to help us in the future.
Yeah.
We're not using it that way yet.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, as we move away from the panels, as you were talking about, and just going straight for exome, genome, that we're going to have so much more data with that, which makes it so much more important to have these systems set up so that there is ways to handle all of this data. And one part that you kind of mentioned too was importing and exporting like information. So what's been your experience with like the ability for these digital tools to import and export like patient records specifically? If you have a new patient intake and it's a referral for somebody else, the experience of being able to input some of that data into the conversation. I don't know, Scott, if you want to start out on that conversation.
Yeah, so ask the question one more time. So more kind of like importing and exporting information in and out of the systems.
Yeah, so if you have a new patient coming into the office to the practice, of taking whatever their medical record information is, whatever format you get that in, the ability to input that into your system.
Gotcha. Yeah, so sorry, we're going to have a visitor. So we have not really used it in that way at this point in time. Like usually the records that we're getting, we are storing those kind of in the traditional medical records. So we're still in a process where we're really actually kind of taking the information and re-inputting it in. I can certainly envision a time that, like right now, if somebody pays me with a check, I take a picture with the phone and it scans all the information in. I bet we can get to a point where these tools, if you take a picture of the medical record, it will then scan it and input the data. So we're not actually abstracting it versus the system can just do it. So not there mm-hmm. yet, but I feel like we can probably get to that point with this type of technology that's available.
Yeah, certainly. And then on the other side of it, with exporting data, if you're sending a patient to somebody else, has that been a different experience of then being able to take that data and share it with them if they're in a different system that they're not one of your coworkers?
No, it hasn't. Well, so it's still more of a, they probably are going to get it by paper and they're going to have mm-hmm. to bring it and that individual will have to scan it. So right now, I'm not aware that any of the digital tools really kind of work like the Epic Care Everywhere, where you can get, if the different centers agree to it, you can see the different information. It'd be great to get to that point, because if there is like one or two main products that are on the market and genetic counselors around the country are all using them, again, it's a big time saver where if you know that a family member was seen at, Ohio State, you can go and pull that information up. It's going to ultimately save you time with your patients.
Yeah, something to definitely like look forward to. And as we all are deciding like which platforms we're using, if genetic counselors end up using more of the same or similar platforms, and that being more of something where you could like almost like a Google Doc of like, oh, share this patient with this person if they're like within your network or something like that. Anything else to add on to this conversation, Amy?
We use Epic, so we do have some access to hospital records via Care Everywhere. But it's only quite limited because there aren't that many other hospitals in the UK currently whose systems are compatible with ours. So that is gradually growing. The other thing that I was thinking about in terms of import and export is in phenotypes, you can export a PED file, which can then be transferred to you. I think pretty much it's a fairly universal file format, so you can then send that to anyone who uses another pedigree drawing tool. What we mostly use that for is exporting pedigree data into our cancer risk assessment program, CanRisk. I think it is built into you a newer version of phenotypes that we don't have yet. So there is going to be some even simpler than it is now, but actually it's pretty simple already. You just export the file, import it into CanRisk, and then it's done. The alternative is what we were previously doing was almost redrawing the pedigree within the risk assessment tool, which pretty tiresome. So that's a nice quick and easy way to add to what we're doing for our patients.
Yeah, certainly. And anything else, Andrew, to add on to this part?
Just quickly, one other thing we use is, again, with some of the intake and pre-screen, we do that in a digital format that we can then export to, you know, discrete values like Excel, so we can have date of birth easily searched and things of that nature. So that's helpful in our end, but nothing too much more advanced than that.
Yeah, certainly. I think something to really keep our eye on for how tools are developing, I think, especially with the pandemic, of these tools being more important than ever, that we're going to, you know, be seeing things that, you know, a month from now, maybe some of this conversation will even be outdated with how quickly things are moving. So kind of going back to just genetic counseling and the different areas that you all work in, when thinking about digital tools, there's, you know, obviously our three main areas of genetic counseling of pediatric, prenatal, and cancer, but, you know, that's kind of also becoming outdated, that there are so many areas of genetic counseling that's becoming much more frequent in our field. What top areas of genetic counseling do you see digital tools having the largest impact of seeing how we're using digital tools and either really improving efficiency, patient experience, that diagnostic process of having that really large impact of looking at that subfield? And Amy, we can start with you to hear your thoughts.
So I think we're perhaps a little bit behind from where Scott was. We're still aiming and hoping to get to the point where patients fill in their family history digitally. That's going to be, you know, such a big step forward for us in terms of time saving. We really shouldn't be entering stuff from paper onto an electronic system. It should just be going in automatically. We're fairly far down the line with that. We know it's possible. It's just a case of mostly getting our hospital IT on side. So that, I think, is going to be such a big time saving. And as Scott was saying, it just frees you up to actually use your genetic counselling skills rather than to be doing data input. And I wonder as well if digital tools can help with some of the educational and sort of visual aids aspects of working with patients. And as genetics is becoming more complex and some of the concepts that we need to convey can be quite difficult, I think sort of user-friendly tools that display somebody's result in a way that it helps you to interpret and make it meaningful for them, I think could potentially be a good area to develop.
Yes, certainly. And Scott, do you have an area to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, we worked with Phenotypes to develop and beta test some of the risk models. So Phenotypes added the Gale model as well as IBIS into their system. So just having those two, where you have the family history already drawn off, if you person has a child, it pulls in a lot of that information. You still need to input a few things that just aren't fields for typically when you're drawing the family history. But with a click of a button, you have two risk models already basically run. And they're currently in the process of validating the PREM model for Lynch syndrome. So for us, it probably took out about 15 minutes of post-session work for running, again, every single breast unaffected woman that comes in for a breast cancer risk assessment, we run the models on. And so if you kind of add that 15 minutes up, of course, you know, thousands of patients, it's a lot of time saved. So for what I do, this is a digital tool that really has made a big difference.
Yeah, certainly, of not just re-entering the same data over and over in different places of, like, you know, and less likely too that making a mistake of missing a number or something along those lines, that you're able to say, okay, here's where the data is. This is the information we're getting out of it, all in that one place. Andrew, anything else to add onto this part?
I think Scott and Amy hit all the big parts there. So nothing groundbreaking to add there.
Do you like science-themed apparel? If you follow us on Instagram at DNA Radio, you've seen how much I love genetic shirts, jewelry, masks, you name it. That's why I want to tell you about Thermo Fisher's Aspire program. It's a rewards program created with scientists like you in mind. Points earned every time you use or purchase lab products. Then you can redeem those points for fun science-themed apparel, career and educational items, and more. One of my friends in the program got a DNA hoodie, and it was clearly designed by a genetics nerd because you zip up the base pairs. Here's a bonus. As a Thermo Fisher Aspire member, you will receive a free full-size trial product every year. You can also use points to get full-size products from their catalog that you haven't tried before. With over 100,000 kits, reagents, antibodies, and other products to select from, you'll be sure to find many valuable options for your research. Best of all, you'll get a full-size products, not just samples, so you'll have enough to really experiment with. Anyone can join. You don't need to be a purchaser. So check it out at thermofisher.com/aspire-DNA today to cash in those 500 bonus points. Again, that's thermofisher.com/aspire-DNA today for 500 bonus points. See the show notes for terms and conditions and that link. Understanding how our DNA contributes to disease risk is no longer science fiction. Polygenic risk scores add up the effects of thousands or even millions of genetic variants spread across the genome. We can use polygenic risk scores to assess how a person's DNA influences their risk of common diseases. Alelica has created a secure and trusted platform for polygenic risk score analysis and reporting. Health systems, clinical laboratories, and research institutions can be equipped with Alelica's cutting-edge tools to deploy polygenic risk scores to identify more people at high risk to reduce the impact of common diseases. Interested in learning more? Visit alelica.com. Alelica, empowering the next generation of clinical genomics. We can kind of talk about then of what genetic counselors should look at in terms of when they're choosing digital tools. There's a couple on the market to look at. What are aspects that are on your list that you suggest genetic counselors looking into when, you know, as they kind of shop around for these in terms of obviously being HIPAA compliant would be one of them. But what other aspects that go into that? Andrew, did you want to start us off?
Sure. So I think, you know, obviously making sure that there's integration possible or, you know, that the IT group at the hospital, clinic, or otherwise allows, you know, that type of integration. So having integration can really, you know, streamline things. So that's one thing, of course. And then also it's ideal if there's ability to integrate risk models and things of that nature. So I think that that'll certainly be as more risk models are developed, having that. Beyond that, just making sure it's intuitive to be able to do with the workflow that you have. If you obtain family history ahead of time, that works in that model, or if you more so prefer, or the clinic model looks at or has family history being obtained during an appointment, to make sure, however that information is input, that again, it works for best how the GCs there operate. So I think those are, you know, a couple of big pieces, and really just to make sure that there's support available from whatever the company who is building this, they're there, and you know that's going to be long term. There's certainly some different models or programs have, you know, shut down over time. So that creates another challenge. So just making sure that someone or a group is reliable, I think, is also ideal there.
Yes, I feel like we should like take that snapshot of all those things and make a list out of it, because I think that's so many important factors to be taking into account when thinking about which tools of, you know, trying out and possibly adopting. Amy, do you have any others to add on to this list?
I think that was most of them. I can't think of anything.
Andrew like covered everything right there. That's great. Scott, anything else for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just echo the support. I think one of the things that, again, with Phenotyp specifically, is when we first started beta testing it, we ran into some issues, and we gave the feedback, and they were extremely open to making those changes so that it worked better. I've worked with other tools where it's like, nope, this is our product, and it's like moving mountains for them to make any changes to make it more user-friendly for not only the clinician, but also the patients. So I really just wanted to echo that support piece in terms of the digital tools.
Yeah, especially if they're able to say, oh, this is an aspect that isn't working for you. How could it be better? And kind of being partners in that so that you don't feel like, oh, it just is what it is. I don't like this. I don't know how to change it. So that it really is dynamic. So now that we may have sold some genetic counselors that digital tools is the way to go. The other really half of the conversation, I would say, is talking about the barriers of actually adopting these. We've talked about how many just benefits can come out of these digital tools and with the time, patient care, and everything that goes along with that. But it can be tough. Amy, you were saying at the beginning that it was tough to actually implement this and switch over from paper to digital tools. What advice do you all have about, you know, approaching either department heads or whoever is making that call of switching over to digital tools, and, you know, how genetic counselors can frame this conversation so that they can really, you know, take what they've learned here today and approach, you know, their supervisors with this information. Amy, did you want to start us off?
Yeah, I mean, I think see it as a business case and sell the advantages. And the advantages are mostly in time saving. In time saving, either trying to find the pedigree, the notes, whatever, which might have been, may not be where they're supposed to be. Time saving in if you can, and I would definitely advise if you're setting this up now to look for something where patients can enter their own information prior to clinic. There are huge time saving gains to be found there. So sort of approach it as a business case, sell the benefits of it. The other thing, of course, is that a lot of people are afraid of change, and that wasn't. It was part of why the transition was so difficult, but it wasn't the only reason. And I think that fear of change does have to be overcome. And I think sometimes it's a case of introducing ideas quite slowly. So introducing the concept, but then sort of gradually coming back to it, because people sometimes need time to adapt to a big shift like that. And we'll need to kind of filter through their questions of, well, how's that going to work? And how's that going to work when they know the sort of ecosystem that they live in and work in, and that's comfortable. They need time to figure out how a new version of that would work. So I think I suppose the message is just don't be disheartened if you initially get a but this, but that response. That's somebody thinking through it. Give them time to do it and just keep, you know, gently coming back to it.
Yeah, and anticipate what those questions are going to be. So you can kind of think out and map, okay, this is where we could go from there if they bring up this question, and kind of do your homework before approaching them. I think that's really good advice. Scott, anything to add about advice of, you know, approaching department heads about adding these digital tools and potential barriers that can happen at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I think Amy really kind of hit on the key ones. I think the two other ones that I would maybe add to that is, one, I think you can make an argument, like, how much has the hospital already spent on their EHR, and to have, you know, they make adoptions to all different types of departments. Well, this is a department specific tool that's needed. And for us to get off of paper and be completely digital, we need this type of tool. And then I think the second argument that you could potentially make as a genetic counselor, if you really are still doing pen to paper, is it's just more HIPAA compliant. Like, if you are seeing your patients and then you're going home and doing some charting in the evening, you're then taking paper out of the hospital with you home to then, you know, write your notes so that you have all the information in front of you. And so to be able to not have to take paper home, be able to just log in and have access to everything, it just is kind of, again, just more HIPAA compliant, just safer in that regard.
Yeah, certainly. I think HIPAA compliant just being really a big factor in all of that, and thinking ways that you can reduce your risk of coming up with any issues with that. Andrew, anything else to add on to this part?
So really, you know, just anytime you're trying to affect large change at an institution, just making sure you have someone, a decision maker who's, you know, a champion that believes in what the change you want to affect, and really just making sure that all of the folks who this would impact are on board, you know, and getting representatives from each to make a reasoned argument, again, looking at the value that this can add, and just making a business proposal, essentially, I think is, you know, a good way to go about it.
Yes, definitely. Well said. I think before we move on to the listener questions here, I had one more question myself that I wanted to get your take on is just where we see digital tools going in the next 5 to 10 years. But I almost want to switch that and say like 1 to 5 years, because I feel like 10 years, that's too hard to tell. So for the next few years, what do you see changing and being the biggest impact of digital tools, like specifically for us as genetic counselors? Scott, did you have something in mind for this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we are going to get to a point where, you know, most of the process probably is going to be digital. Something that I described earlier, where the patient's really engaging with some sort of digital tool, whether it's videos, whether it's a chatbot, whether it's something that's really allowing the patient to get a lot of that pre-education so that when they get to the healthcare provider, again, it's really more of a targeted session. Or I do think it's possible that with some of these tools, if we're able to integrate potentially some psychosocial tools. So again, maybe in the cancer setting, like looking at cancer anxiety, cancer depression, cancer worry, and maybe that to allow us to see more patients and work at our top of scope, maybe there are some patients that can go through an entire digital process and not talk to a genetic counselor on the front end. A test gets ordered, and then we're available on the back end to answer questions about the test results. But for patients that are going through this process and they kind of flag that there's anxiety or worry or concern, then they get kind of off-ramped from the fully digital process to the genetic counselor for that more one-on-one meeting. There's a lot of people that are ordering their own genetic testing at different companies. So there are some people that may not need us up front that really we can work with on the back end. And I think the digital tools are really going to allow for that process to work.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept to think about of, you know, we sometimes get focused so much on the genetic information and the decision-making part, but also knowing that with so much of this, there is that psychosocial component that sometimes is one that we talk about with these digital tools because, you know, as genetic counselors, a lot of our training is focused on that psychosocial component and computers don't have as much training on that. So certainly it's something that we can focus on and see how that is changing in the future and being able to funnel patients more efficiently. Amy, do you have anything that comes to mind of looking at the future of digital tools?
I've got kind of two things which are sort of at either ends and a bit of a sort of democratization of genetic information. So one being tools that help non-genetics providers. So like the risk assessment tools, which will basically tell them either this patient needs this screening or you should refer this patient to a genetic counselor. So to sort of empower them a bit to be making some of those decisions. I think some of those do already exist. And the other one is at the patient end of the spectrum. And I've seen quite a few studies where people have trialed, and I'm not sure there's any actually out there and active and live and public at the moment, but apps and websites that patients can use to share genetic information with their families. So, you know, at the point where we find a pathogenic variant in a patient and it's sort of then they're then charged with informing their relatives about it. It's a digital way of doing that because, of course, you know, as Scott was saying, everything's digital. Everyone expects it to be digital. They don't expect like when you get a paper and stencil out to do a pedigree, they get a letter to give to their family who they probably only communicate with on WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger. It's like, what am I going to do with a letter?
Take a picture of the letter and then send it, right?
They mostly do that.
Right.
But an app could be, you know, because it could then contain some information about it. They can click through, it could tell them, like they could put in their postal code and it would tell them where they need to get referred to. It could be much more interactive. So I think that's a sort of a future area.
Yeah, and definitely areas where it could be more anonymous too, of being able to have, oh, this is your family member's information that we can share and not say that this is coming from you. And that's going to be much easier with digital tools as opposed to sending some kind of something in the mail. And they're like, well, where is this coming from? And, you know, less easier to track and talk to the genetic counselor it's coming from. So that's certainly an area to be looking at. And yeah, as you said, people are not expecting, when you hand them a piece of paper, they're like, what am I supposed to do with this? This is not going in my computer. Andrew, anything that comes to mind when thinking about the future?
Yeah. So Scott and Amy both hit on wonderful points that I very much agree with. I think the one other thing I would want to point out, and I've sort of talked about this a little bit, is a lot of these digital tools do produce data in different ways that hasn't been completely integrated into, you know, bioinformatic pipelines for exome, genome, other methodologies that are, you know, coming down the pipeline. So, you know, having this information be integrated into that process, I think is really going to give us just another piece to the puzzle to help further diagnose folks, and as polygenic risk scores get better and improve, I think we're going to see a lot of benefit from including the data from these digital tools as far as diagnosis and just giving providing information to families and patients to make decisions off of.
Yes, certainly well said all around. We do have some viewer listener questions here that we can get to. And so the first question is, does PhenoTips support complex pedigrees, for example, with multiple partners and consanguinity? I can answer that really quick that yes, the answer is yes. Multiple partners in there, consanguinity is a box you can check off. So I think we can kind of check that one off the list that we've answered that. So the answer is yes.
Consanguinity is better than that, actually. So you can just mark a single relationship as consanguineous, but you can also drag. So you can get the partner node from a person on their pedigree and drag it to somebody else to attach them. So you can make a consanguineous relationship by literally joining two people who are on your pedigree.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I'll have to see that. I saw the box for it that I've used.
It's neat. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So actually, I mean, those are things that, as Scott was saying, they've developed, FinTips have been brilliant at being responsive at changing things. And that's one thing that they improved was how it handles consanguinity. So yeah, it does it really well.
Yeah, certainly. And so our next question is there a software that has phenotyping applications and facilitates genetic evaluations, like a dysmorphology software? Does PhenoTips have something like this? I don't know if anyone can speak to this question.
I can't speak specific to PhenoTips, but I do know there is software out there. I don't know if I can name the software, but if you look it up, there is software out there that will take basically data points from your whole face, and I believe they're working on other metrics as well, to then suggest a potential diagnosis off of that. Obviously, it's just one piece of the puzzle, but there's a lot of good software out there that can that also can integrate into analysis for certain labs are using that type of information as well. So hopefully that helps.
Certainly. Anything else to add, Amy, Scott?
I mean, I think if you really enter into PhenoTips the very specific dysmorphological, that's the right term, feature, and multiple of those features, it will do differential diagnosis. And then I also think that it will, maybe speaking out of turn here, but I think it also, if you put that information in and have a VCF file, I think there's some connection between that too. So it has that functionality. I just, again, not doing a lot of pediatrics, I don't really use it at this point.
Yeah, and it does. PhenoTips can do deep phenotyping based on text recognition there. And I believe our next webinar is going to be focusing on this. So a bit of a teaser there. If you have patients with Prader-Willi syndrome, please let them know about a new clinical study looking for participants across the United States. This study will be evaluating the safety and impact of an investigational medication. The study will focus on excessive daytime sleepiness, cognition, and behavioral function in people with Prader-Willi syndrome. The study participation is 4 months long and consists of 5 visits. If you're a patient, at your visits, you will participate in sleep tests and have general check-ins on how you're feeling. There are 13 trial sites in the United States with travel reimbursements for families. You can also learn more about other clinical studies for genetic disorders through knowrare.com. There are studies for sickle cell, achondroplasia, cystic fibrosis, and more. Again, that's knowrare.com. Stay tuned for a full episode about Prader-Willi syndrome, including this study on November 19th. Refer yourself, a patient, or a loved one to the study by visiting the links in the show notes, which is also available at dnapodcast.com. For centuries, humanity has imagined a magical fountain that could unlock eternal youth. New scientific advances suggest this might actually be a reality in the not-too-distant future. Journalist Keith MacArthur explores the mysteries of aging and unlocking the fountain from CBC Podcasts, where you'll meet dreamers, skeptics, and cutting-edge scientists, including those who believe that the first person who will live to 150 years old has already been born. Keith MacArthur hosted Unlocking Bryson's Brain, which I recommended last year, and now you can tune into his brand new podcast. I've already binged all the episodes released so far, so catch up with me by listening to Unlocking the Fountain everywhere you get your podcasts. Our next question is, what is the process of drawing a detailed pedigree on an online medium while speaking to the patient? Doesn't it get difficult to keep track on the conversation and simultaneously draw the pedigree? So we talked about this a little bit earlier in the webinar, but any additional thoughts there on just that experience, especially if it's a more detailed pedigree and it's not necessarily writing live and well on most people?
I think it's just practice.
Just like anything, right?
I know because I have colleagues who are newer to using it who don't feel so comfortable, but I don't feel a barrier in my brain between what I'm doing on Phenotips and the conversation that I'm having with the patient. And I think that's just familiarity with it. There are some tricks which help, like using the tab key to move between the boxes rather than going back to your mouse all the time. Definitely use the number keypad for dates of birth rather than scrolling for things and for ages. That makes it so much quicker. So if you're doing a telephone consultation, it's quite easy because you only need the pedigree in front of you. For video consultations, it does help to have two screens, or split your screen so that you can see your patient and also work on the pedigree at the same time. But I think if the thought of that daunts you, I think it's just because you've not tried doing it. And I think when you start doing it, you feel comfortable with it and confident, I don't find it a problem at all.
Yeah. Definitely. Scott, did you have something to add on to that as well?
It's just surprisingly easy. I think once you do it, it's not that different. And Amy mentioned it earlier. It's a way to engage with your patients where if it's a video appointment and you share your screen, they can see what you're building at the same time. And often they'll kind of comment like, oh, this is pretty cool. And, you know, what does this symbol mean? And so it does allow for more engagement with the patients versus, again, if you're kind of writing with your head down, looking up, it's really just facing you at that point in time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point in that with this, it's like, okay, if you're drawing the line, then the box or the circle, that is probably going to take more time compared to just clicking one button of like, oh, adding a brother, adding a sister. So I think, yeah, once you get through a couple pedigrees, you're like, oh, wow, why have I been doing drawing for years? Andrew, anything else to add on to that one?
Just to say, you know, every time you're trying something new, it's okay to, you know, check in with the patient and say, you know, I'm just learning this new software. Obviously, you know, I've been doing genetic counseling for X amount of years. So it doesn't take away from your, what is the word I'm looking for? Like, you know what you're doing. So, addressing that, you know, this is a new software. It might take a few seconds, I think, is totally fine. And I did that when I started because I take a little while to figure things out and no one ever, balked at that at all. So I think that's fine as well.
Yeah. And even just taking some time, it's like, take your favorite book series or something and just play around with it of adding and see how quickly you can do it of knowing that information and just playing around with it, and the vast amount of downtime we all have. So another question we have is, does the pedigree system at Phenotips, is it inclusive to LGBTQ of the queer community?
So this was a change that we requested as well, because in an early version of Phenotips, it wouldn't let you have, by default, if you set up a partnership, one would be male and one would be female. So that is no longer the case. In a partnership can be male, can be both female. There's a diamond symbol which you can use either if you don't know a gender or if somebody is non-binary. What we don't currently have, I'm not sure that there are agreed symbols at the moment. I know that one of our trainee genetic counselors is doing a master's project on this at the moment, but so symbols for trans men and trans women, I'm not sure that there are agreed symbols for them at the moment. So I think it's, you know, I'm sure that if there are agreed symbols, I'm sure Phenotips would be happy to incorporate them, but that is something. So at the moment, you just have to put one gender and then put in your comments, in your notes, if somebody is trans.
And to follow up on that, if someone's using an egg or sperm donor, is that also easy to add in, or is it more making a note on the pedigree?
I think it's making a note on the pedigree. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you can definitely put in adopted status, but I don't mm-hmm. think there's a gamete donor option. I could be wrong. I haven't looked for it specifically.
Yeah, that's something.
No prenatal people on the call here. So.
And another question we have before we wrap up is, can you talk more about the educational tools for patients that are being developed? What is the format? Are these resources interactive? So I don't know if anyone can speak to the educational tools. I know for myself, I've kind of developed them on my own and that's what I use, but I don't know if about any of you guys.
I mean, you know, at Genome Medical, we basically, we took the genetic counselors and we wrote scripts for the content that we would want in our videos. And then we hired an animation company that then took the scripts, animated them, and then obviously we get to review them, see what the images look like, what the animation looks like. And again, kind of built it on our own. I think a lot of centers have done this, and some of it, you can see some of the videos on YouTube. A lot of the centers maybe put them out there for their patients to look at ahead of time. So there's a lot of different templates out there for those type of educational tools.
Yes, definitely. And so I think that about wraps it up for this webinar. Definitely stay tuned for our next webinar on December 9th. So this is going to be, as I teased earlier, phenotyping in the era of genome medicine. And this is going to be featuring Dr. Olaf Bobenmer, and he is the Associate Chief of Genetics and Genomics at Boston Children's Hospital. You will see a feedback link emailed to you. Please take out a minute to offer your feedback about today's webinar and pick topics you would like to see us cover in the upcoming series. The email is also going to include a link to Phenotyp Speaker Series page where you can sign up to receive alerts on upcoming sessions so that you don't miss any of them. But also all the recordings of our previous sessions are on there as well. So you can watch them on demand. If you watched it before, maybe you need to watch back to catch something that we said. And Phenotyps is also going to be at NSGC, which is virtual this year. So you can stop by their booth for a free student account. They're also going to be showcasing their new cancer risk assessment tool and a new tool that auto draws pedigrees using patient entered data, which is what we've talked about today. So if you'd like to follow us on social media, you can search DNA Today on social media and podcast players for myself, along with dnapodcast.com. And I don't know if you guys want to share your social media as well. Andrew, I think you had a couple that you wanted to share there.
Oh, sure. So yeah, we're on Twitter at Clover Genetics, Clover_Genetics. And then we put out a blog post about once a month on different topics related to genetics on our website, clovergenetics.com. So certainly check us out there.
And Amy or Scott, do you have any social media to plug?
Mine is on the screen. It's at Chicago Genetics is the private practice. Genome Medical is at Genome Med. Yeah.
All right. And Amy, yours is also on the screen, it looks like.
Well, that's just the hospital. To be honest, I avoid using social media professionally. I'm low profile. So yeah, that's just the hospital I work for.
So they have to catch you in webinars then. They have to look out for when you're speaking. So yeah, definitely check out phenotyps.com for all information. If we didn't get to your question today, you can certainly chat us right now and we'll be sure to email you back. One of our lovely panelists can answer your questions. So I know we had a lot today, so we got to as many as we could in the hour. So thank you again for everybody that's tuned in. And thank you so much, Andrew, Scott, and Amy for joining us today and sharing your expertise. I think it was just so helpful to hear how you're using the digital tools, how genetic counselors can adopt them, and you know, really, why should they adopt them? So I think we dived into so many topics today. So really appreciate you taking the time to educate our audience today. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kira.
All right, we'll see you all next time, December 9th. Mark your calendars so that you can tune into Phenotyping in the Era of Genome Medicine. So thank you for tuning in, everybody. It's been lovely to chat throughout the world here. So hope you all have a really great week.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.